Good morning and very welcome to the programme. If you want to get in touch with us today, you can text us. 51551 is the number as always. The email address is todaycb@rte.ie or on Twitter we are at Today with Clare. I'm Taoiseach Micheál Martin. You're very welcome to the studio. Thanks for coming in today. We've a lot to discuss, but the first thing I want to talk to you about is something that people will be, I'm sure, talking about today. Because you said to your parliamentary party meeting last night, when they were pushing you on cutting the VAT rate on fuel, you said the price of fuel is not your biggest concern. Are you concerned about fuel shortages?
Well, sorry, yeah, I did say that in terms of that. First of all, we have to look at this over the 12-month perspective now. This is not something that we can respond to on a week-to-week basis. It needs a longer time frame. So in that context, not just in Ireland, but right across Europe, energy security and security of supply is a key issue, and particularly as Europe reduces its dependency on Russian gas and oil, and that's a clearly stated objective now of the European Union.
So how worried
are you? Countries like Germany, for example,
I mean,
are very determined to do that.
You'll see the front of this today. Taoiseach, we could run out of winter fuel.
But I never said that. That's not the phrase I used at all. I simply used the phrase energy security is an issue that the government is focused on. And also that would mean then we have to look at demand reduction sort of strategies as well, and a more informed approach over the medium term, a planned approach to this, insofar as we can, but in a period of great uncertainty arising out of the Ukrainian war.
It's quite something to hear you saying you're more concerned about that than you are about the price of it.
Well, I think, again, look, I think comments are being taken out of context. We are very concerned about the cost and the rising course we are. It's not an either or. But what I'm trying to convey to people is the need that we need to look at this over a longer time frame than just a week-to-week basis. Okay. So that every week there will, you know, we're getting increases. And if we look at the cost of gas a year ago compared to today, it's just an exponential growth. So therefore, we need a medium-term strategy to address this. We've already allocated about $2 billion from the budget onwards in alleviating pressures on people. But obviously, the price rises have continued because of the war on Ukraine, which have exacerbated the situation. So therefore, there's a number of things we must do. As we plan ahead for the fiscal situation and the budget next year, we have to target our resources to people who are hardest hit and to those who are suffering the most.
Okay.
We have to look after sectors like we did with the hauliers, agriculture, where input costs are high.
Can I come to those measures in a moment? Because I really want to nail this down, because when you have a headline like that, you know what it's going to lead to. People panic.
Well, I'm not responsible for the headline now, and that phrase was not one I used at all.
But you did say the price of fuel is not your biggest concern.
No, I didn't use that phrase either. I mean, I've simply said energy security is something we have to focus on and prepare for over the next winter period.
But are you confident, for example, that we have a 90-day supply here?
Yeah, we have that, yeah.
And people needn't be concerned and they shouldn't go out and panic buy?
Absolutely not. No need for that. But I think we need to, the very important point is this. This is a longer haul than people might have anticipated because of the war in Ukraine. We already had problems coming out of COVID, very fast rebound of the economy, imbalance between supply and demand, and prices were going up.
Mm-hmm.
War on Ukraine happens, and a very dramatic escalation in oil and gas prices as a result of that, with consequential impacts on the wider economy. Food security is an issue for us also.
Yeah.
And I made that point last evening to the parliamentary party, that the knock-on from war in terms of grain, in terms of food issues, nutrition, could be further problems in developing countries, which creates further migratory flows and further potential conflict in developing countries arising from the food security issue. So there are very serious issues emanating from the war, in short.
And the push on you last night was about VAT on fuel, wasn't it? And people might look at this and say, well, I've got a really big bill to deal with here now, right? So what we're looking at is, on the one hand, people are getting €200 for their fuel bill, and they'll welcome that, no doubt. But you're trying to change behaviour then, on the other hand, by increasing carbon tax in May. Is it all a bit mad, doing the two things in tandem?
Well, first of all, the war has created a situation where we have to stand back from what business as usual and reassess the short-term measures that we have to take, but then double down on renewables. One very clear policy shift that is emerging from this crisis is the need to accelerate renewable energy not just here, but across Europe. And that is a policy position that has been adopted by the European Union. In the short term, across Europe, they're doing everything they can to get short term supplies in through LNG and other mechanisms to reduce their dependence on Russian gas and oil. We are not as dependent on Russian gas and oil as others are. Our primary imports are from the UK and from Norway. But nonetheless, we do have to adapt, and we're going to have to assess all of these issues.
Yeah, what's the message, though, that we're sending? You know, you're looking at and being asked by your parliamentary party to look at VAT on fuel, but you're increasing it on the carbon side.
Well, that wasn't the dominant issue last evening in terms of that. But I hear your point in terms of, like, the carbon tax is a more permanent feature. It's legislated for. Reductions in VAT or excise duties of necessity would be temporary to deal with the current crisis. The carbon tax gives revenue to enable us to do energy efficiency, for example, to do the retrofitting in homes, mm-hmm. which ultimately is a better way to get people to have lower bills well into the future.
Which is grand. But if I'm trying to pay for my petrol at the petrol station, an increase in May, people can't take that.
But in terms of, I take that point, and that's why we reduced. We've already, brought in about 2 billion in measures. Even since January, we had a package of 500 million. And then a further package some weeks ago of 320 million.
It made no odds to people. You know, so many people who say that made no difference to me.
Well, I put it this way, if we didn't do it, it would have made things be much worse. Mm. And again, I take the point, you can't keep chasing increases. And so therefore, all we can do is help to the best of our ability in terms of our capacity within the Exchequer to support people in this exceptional period where prices have grown exponentially because of a number of factors, but most crucially now the war on Ukraine. And
Pascal Donoghue said, you know, we can't do everything for people. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
There's only so much that you can do.
I said that myself as well, and we can't, as I said yesterday in the press briefing, we cannot react on a weekly basis either.
I had a woman on from Bernardo's on the show on Monday night on the television programme, and she said to me that by Tuesday they are trying to provide hot meals for children because the social welfare has run out. There's no light, there's no heat on in those homes. And she was pleading for targeted resources for families like that.
I agree that that's what we're going to have to do. And I said that last evening, that we need in future allocation of measures and resources, they have to be targeted to people most in need, to households under the most pressure. And that will have to be our direction of travel.
What would that look like?
Well, I think already, if you look at, for example, the increase in the fuel allowance that we've already brought in, it's been quite significant. It's doubled now since this government came into power. And if you add in the €200, you know, it's a significant increase. But I think we have to go further on that and perhaps expanding eligibility around the fuel allowance. Now, these are all specific proposals that have to be considered by government, and I'm not preempting those deliberations. But also families with children, that we would take steps through social protection that would protect families with children and give them an extra help and an extra assistance, as Heather Humphreys has done in previous social protection allocations.
She was saying as well, that woman from Bernardo's, Kerry, that if there was a hot meal in every school, it would make a great deal of difference.
Well, we've made significant progress in expanding the Hot Meal Schools programme. And I've asked for consideration to be given, particularly in DESH schools, that we would increase facilities in those schools to facilitate the delivery of hot meals. Because I do support that as an issue, because it's important for children.
The Taoiseach has asked the Minister for Finance to examine this 30% tax rate. Was that a surprise to you to hear that? It's not in the programme for government. It just popped up, was it last week or the week before?
Well, it's not in the programme for government. And but of course, people are entitled to articulate perspectives and viewpoints and so mm-hmm. on.
And that was debated on this programme, where it was said by Josepha Madigan, he's entitled to suggest this. But it's one thing if I suggest it and people can say, yeah, grand, whatever you're having yourself. But when the Taoiseach suggests, it's different ballgame.
Well, in one sense it is. But in the other sense, we are thankfully a democracy, and we do allow the full flow of opinions and viewpoints.
And what do you think?
My own view is, given the war now, is that we can't make any specific predictions in terms of the budget. And I think everything has changed because of the war in Ukraine, to be frank. We're going to have to stand back a bit now in terms of preparing for the next budget and take the longer view in terms of the implications of this war on our fiscal situation, as well as expenditures, because expenditures.
So it might be premature to start looking at 30% tax rate.
But I think again that's open, and people are entitled to bring issues to the table to discuss in the context of the budget with three parties in the government.
Yeah, you're not saying to me now you think it's a good idea and it's worth exploring.
What I'm saying, as I think at the moment, is that our pressure points now are on the expenditure side. We will have to give alleviation to people, and that can be by a combination of tax relief or additional expenditures in education and health and so on. Because there will be, you know, SIPTU and other organisation and Congress have already indicated their desire for pay and so on like that to deal with the current crisis. We have to be wary of and very cautious about wage inflationary spirals that we might only add to the problem. So I think working with the social partners, and that's what I would like to do, I think we have to be intelligent in terms of how we respond to this inflationary cycle, which is the highest since the early 2000s. And it's a very serious cycle, and one that calls for a very, I think, evidence-based response, working in dialogue with the social partners. That could involve a certain degree of relief as well. But again, a lot depends on the next number of months, because what came across at the Council, European Council meeting last week, was the uncertainty, real uncertainty around energy across Europe. Europe itself is redesigning the energy market. The Commission is, in terms of the influence of gas on energy prices, for example. Some would regard it as disproportionate, particularly those now who have a high degree of renewables as a factor in electricity generation. And also then the whole idea of a price cap across Europe. And that's caused differences of opinion. There's tensions within Europe on that. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and I have to stress that. And in the context of that uncertainty, I think we have to have a look at it from a principles perspective. You've already identified one in terms of looking after those who are most impacted, but also working with stakeholders in society, those who represent workers and employers, and saying, how can we, in the best interest of all of us, navigate our way through this very difficult period now
uncertainty, does that mean that the estimate which has been put on dealing with the crisis in Ukraine, the estimate for Ireland at 2.5 billion, that is also an uncertain figure?
Yes, it is uncertain. It can't be definitive. But I think it's prudent for particularly the Minister for Public Expenditure, Michael McGrath, to lay it out, the potential costs.
And there's been talk about using the COVID recovery fund, at least in part, for that. But that's not going to be enough, is it?
That will have to be used in 2022. But it won't be enough for 2023. It will enable us to meet targets, our overall fiscal frameworks, hopefully, at the end of 2022.
Will Ireland set a limit on the number of Ukrainian refugees we can take?
No, we're not setting that limit. We're part of a European-wide protective measure. I think the war on Ukraine, I think, has really generated an extraordinary response from the Irish people. I think people across Europe are shocked at the inhumanity of this war. And the pictures we witnessed, we thought we'd never witness again in Europe, and we are. And I think people want us to respond in that manner. I was at a school completion program last evening at a conference organized by Forsa, and I met a Ukrainian woman afterwards, but the entire audience were as one in supporting the national effort to help the people of Ukraine. That was an education audience, and education practitioners, teachers, principals, and so on.
We heard from the Minister for Housing, Dara O'Brien, yesterday about the pressure that this is going to put on us from a housing perspective, just to take that one issue. I mean, 200,000, can we cope with 200,000 people arriving here from Ukraine?
I think it'll be the largest crisis we've ever responded to from a refugee perspective. We've never had these numbers before. We're at about 16,000 today, and that will grow, that will demand an exceptional response over and above the norm. I think that does mean, in terms of some planning issues, in terms of some temporary accommodation provision, modular housing, which can take months. We do need to get into that
modular
now.
Modular housing is one thing, but I mean, when we hear about women and children in the main fleeing shelling in Ukraine and coming to Ireland to stay in a tent in Gormanstown, can we not do better than that?
Well, so far we've of about 16,000 have come into the country, and many in the initial phase went with families or people that they knew. Now about two-thirds are seeking accommodation, which we are providing. But this is an extraordinary number, and I think we have to be realistic we have to make provision for if those numbers increased, for example, in the next week. And there's no, there has been a pattern of about 500 to 600 a day, and that can go up, and some days it can be higher.
Have you been told that we will need to use those tents, that tent?
Yes, that is a very, not just a possibility, a probability in the short term that those would have to be used. We have to make the provision for it. We hope we don't have to. And that, you know, we're working through a whole range of options that are there to try and avoid that.
And how long do you expect people will have to stay in those tents?
Well, see, if you take Mariupol and you take what's going on there, you take, for example, the Russian strategy in the last 2 days, pretending that they were going to pull back and reduce the intensity of the war. And actually the opposite happened in terms of the bombing of Kiev and neighbourhoods around Kiev. And there's no doubt in my view that's the strategy to really target civilians. And Putin wants to create this migratory flow and this migration pressure on Europe. We have to be clear to President Putin that we will not buckle under that.
So the strategy is to put us under pressure in this way?
No question. No question in my view. That is part of the Russian strategy.
There was hopes, wasn't there, yesterday that there was going to be a breakthrough in negotiations when we heard about the ceasefire and the pullback from Kiev and Chernihiv. Do you trust anything that they say now?
No, I don't. Actions will have to speak louder than words. To be fair, I think the American intelligence, and this has been spot on from the beginning, in advance of the war, I think UK intelligence has been strong on this also. And they've called it right in respect of what was going to happen. I think I would appeal again to the Russian Federation to stop this immoral and inhumane war on people. It's a war on people. Mm-hmm. This is a war that is targeting civilians. And it's so cynical. And so inhumane as to defy any rational thinking.
Okay. Well, Dara O'Brien told us yesterday that we'll need 35,000 additional homes along with the 33,000 that we need every year. It's an extraordinary figure, isn't it, over the next 5 to 6 years. Are we going to get any budgetary support from the EU to deal with this?
Not a whole lot, to be honest. We have to develop and provide for this out of own resources. There will be some funding from Europe under the Home Affairs budget, which is a budget that's there for migration. There's some cohesion funds, but we wouldn't be in line for much there because of the economic progress that Ireland has made over the last decades. So it'll be primarily own resources.
Yeah, and people who are suffering because of the housing crisis, when they heard that yesterday, I'm sure they were throwing their hands up going, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen now in my search to try and buy a home?
I think it's, you know, we had a housing crisis before all of this. We need to rapidly ramp up housing provision, which we are. Thankfully, last year was about 31,000 starts. But we're coming from a lower base of about 20,000 houses in 2019, 2020, because of the lockdown and so on, reduced construction. I genuinely believe that we have to really move faster on the planning side, on the delivery side. In terms of house construction.
So even though we were told that all the stops were being pulled out to deal with the housing crisis as it was pre-Ukraine, you're saying that more can be done. There's more capacity in a market that's already being pushed to the pin of its collar.
Well, I think in terms of the Ukrainian situation, because a lot of provision will have to be made even on a temporary basis in terms of reconversions and so on like that, we're going to have to take executive action that really enables us to do that without having to be waiting for months for planning permission to do it.
So that's going to push people's rights when it comes to their property, to property that isn't being used at the moment? I mean, how do you do that? How do you move that along quicker than it's being moved at the moment?
Well, I think in terms of the emergency accommodation, I think that's the context I'm talking about there.
Are you talking about state-owned property there?
I think state-owned properties or where we might be reconversion of facilities and so on like that. People will have to facilitate that now.
Okay, and Irish citizens who offered accommodation, the pledges of accommodation, we know there were many thousands of people who agreed to do that. Are we going to stretch the goodwill there now because we will not have places to move people on to after 6 months to a year?
Well, again, it depends. A lot depends on the duration of the war itself, Claire. I think many of the Ukrainians who are here will want to return to their homes. I mean, the Ukrainians I met yesterday, for example, have parents back in Ukraine. They have family back in Ukraine. They're very emotional when you talk to them because of the anxiety that they're feeling.
Of course they want to go home, but their homes and their towns have been blown to smithereens.
But I think that needs to be said, though, because that's an important aspect of all of this, because this comes back to the uncertainty that I've spoken about in relation to all of this. And in terms of the people and we don't want to stretch people's goodwill. I take that point, but that though they do give us the timeline though, and give us an opportunity to get other provision in place, which I think that's crucial. Mm-hmm. That's where I see the real value of those pledges, that they give us time to get other housing units in place.
But there may be homeowners who'll say, "Look, I'm very happy to give people a home for 6 months to a year." But will they be sitting there in 2 years' time because the government hasn't managed to find a place for people to move on to? And will that then prevent people from offering accommodation?
I think we will be in a position, I think, to certainly over the next 12 months, to be in a position to dramatically increase housing provision from where it is. And to continue consistently increase it. But we are at a capacity stretch. I mean, I'm not sort of denying that. The problem is the war, and we've got to respond, and it's a wartime situation.
The other issue that people
on the continent of Europe,
people are concerned about here now, of course, is COVID. And Dr. Fergal Hickey this morning, an emergency consultant on Morning Ireland, saying that they've taken the unprecedented step of issuing a joint statement with the INMO. They say that the situation in emergency departments is intolerable and unsafe. Now, is there anything you can do to answer that call from him, to take some measure to help?
Well, first of all, we're guided all along by public health and public health advice in relation to COVID-19. You know, I've been in touch with the chief medical officer, discussed it with him and with the HSE. This is a highly transmissible variant now, the BA2, much more transmissible than any variant we've witnessed before. And so therefore, but thankfully, it's not as virulent or doesn't appear to be damaging health to the same extent as earlier variants did. Not causing greater hospital admissions or the ICU in particular is remaining fairly stable. What it does do, of course, it does put enormous pressure on hospitals because of the fact that if you take a hospital like Kerry Hospital, 250 beds, 100 patients with COVID, some what we call incidental, they go in for something else and diagnosed with COVID, that then demands isolation. Treatments and so on. It puts huge pressure on the hospital system.
And that's why you have Fergal Hickey on the radio this morning pleading with you to do something.
But do something isn't an answer. I mean, you have to understand, like, basically, and that's the first point. The second point is a lot of nursing homes have become outbreak centres, which means then that slows down the transfer of patients mm-hmm. from the acute hospital phase into the nursing homes. Delayed discharges are very high at the moment because we cannot move patients into areas where there have been outbreaks. So all of that has created a perfect storm in hospitals. And I accept fully the problems, but suggesting that if we just brought in masks or something, that it could change all that, just doesn't, I think, cut
well,
it in terms of...
he says a return to mask wearing in indoor settings and working from home where possible would lessen the risks to patients and staff.
But the guidance is that people should wear masks, but the regulatory situation wouldn't, in my view at this stage, change the hospital pressures, is the point I'm making. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a new phase of COVID-19. We have a new phase of COVID-19. It's a more transmissible variant.
But if you have your doctors and nurses saying to you, we can't cope with this, the system is
breaking
here.
There's a wider issue there that we need to deal with in terms of the AED. But I'm saying from the COVID perspective.
Right. But in this moment, they're saying, would you not do something to mitigate against the impact of COVID infection? And you're saying, no, because the CMO says I shouldn't.
Well, what we're saying is the public health advice is strongly...
The CMO isn't in a hospital, with all due respect to him.
But all due respect, Steph, as well, Claire, this is a highly transmissible disease. We can't ignore the advice around the virus, which is basically that it's extraordinarily hard to stop this particular variant from transmission.
What would
from
it cost you to for the government to say, you have to wear a mask now indoors? It's not a choice anymore. Like, what's the problem with doing that? I don't understand why it's an issue.
Well, again, first of all, we are advising that people should wear masks.
But that's no good.
I don't agree with that. It's not good.
Because there's only 60% of people, as Dara O'Brien told me yesterday when he was on the Dart, 60% of people wearing a mask, right? We've been told before by immunologists that masks are no good unless everybody's wearing them in an indoor setting.
Well, first of all, I don't think public advice is no good. I think public advice is important. Public health advice, is important and should never be dismissed. The view is, from public health, by the way, that this variant is so transmissible that it's almost impossible to stop transmission in relation to it.
Masks or no masks. You know, they're saying masks don't work on this
people
variant.
Wear masks, they take masks off and so on. Hopefully, and it's a bit early yet, I acknowledge that we're seeing some positive signals in terms of the this wave of this particular variant. What it does point to is another phase of COVID where it's more disruptive of society then earlier phases were more, you know, damaging in health terms and in terms of mortality. And that's something we're going to have to come to grips with as the journey of this virus continues. It's not gone away.
You're hands off now on this.
We're not hands off. We're going to, obviously, we're putting a new advisory group together to really advise government over the next 12 months in relation to how the journey of COVID continues and how we deal with that in terms of its impact on society at large. Essentially, the current wave does not justify the return of economic restrictions or the restrictions that we had in earlier phases of COVID-19. That's the fundamental advice from public health.
And the doctors aren't asking for that, in fairness to them. They're just asking for a return to mask wearing and advice to work from home. That's all they're asking for.
But let's take the work from home. Like, not all offices are fully returned. Yeah, people are. We still are in a phased basis in terms of
most
working from home.
A lot of people are
still doing a hybrid system at the moment, where there are some days in the office and there are some days at home. But that in itself isn't guaranteed to stop the transmission.
So your response to Fergal Hickey and to the IMO is we're not going to do what you've asked us to do.
No, I would say to the IMO, look, we have to stick to the centrality of advice being the public health advice. That's the point. That's the discipline that is the key discipline, along with infectious disease and so on, that guides us and has guided us from the very beginning of COVID-19. I take people are entitled to articulate their positions and so on like that, but it's the public health advice has to be centre stage in terms of how we react and respond to the crisis, to the COVID situation.
A couple of other things I wanted to ask you about. The Ukrainian president, when he said that Ireland was so-so or almost behind them when he was talking about their application to join the EU, have you managed to clarify what he meant by that?
Yes, I mean, the Ukrainian government are very clear that the interpretation of that is not the position of the Ukrainian government.
How it seemed.
Yeah, they're very clear that they're very thankful to Ireland. I just met with the ambassador again the other evening. The foreign minister has been in touch with Minister Coveney in respect of that as well. And as publicly said, very thankful for the very, very, very strong support of Ireland, particularly in respect of Ukrainians' application to join the European Union, which we've been proactively supporting at the European Council level.
Was it a misspeak or what do you think?
I was there and I didn't actually react in the way that people subsequently did.
Well, he was very positive about some countries and then he said, Ireland, almost.
Well, again, I don't know, was that in translation or whatever, but I spoke to him the week before in Washington, and he was very much on top of the detail of the Irish contribution to Ukraine, having the specific figures in terms of the financial contributions, humanitarian contribution, and also in particular in relation to Ireland supporting, which is an important point, their application to join the European Union.
So you don't think he has a problem with us?
No.
The Russians, on the other hand, you expelled 4 Russian diplomats. We don't know why. We assume it's because they were operating as spies here. Are you expecting retribution against our diplomats there?
Well, again, that's the matter for the Russian government, or the Russian Federation government.
Nothing has happened so far.
Nothing has happened so far. Our view is, and you know, I received clear security advice, as did Minister Simon Coveney, in respect of these individuals. And on that security advice, we took the decision that we took. Again, we've made that very clear to the Russian Federation government.
I just want to ask you about neutrality, because you and your party voted against that Dáil motion calling for neutrality to be inserted into the constitution by referendum. The Taoiseach, though, said Fine Gael should set out its opposition to this triple lock system, which people might be familiar with. So it prevents Irish troops from serving in peacekeeping missions without authorisation from the government, the Dáil and the United Nations. And there are growing fears now, aren't there, that what's happening in Ukraine could just bounce us into a quick decision on our neutrality.
Well, I've made it very clear I'm against a knee-jerk response, or I'm against being bounced into any decision on this. Because anything we're doing so far and our military neutrality is not impairing our response to the Ukrainian crisis or the European Union's response. So, for example, we were able to participate in the peace facility deployment by the European Union for the first time. The European Union did it for the first time. They allocated lethal weapons to Ukraine to defend themselves. We made our per capita contribution financially, but it was for the non-lethal dimension of that support base, using a facility called constructive abstention. So the point I would make is this. Over the years, we have evolved our security and defence policies. We're part of the European security and defence discussions and policy. As just last week, the strategic compass was approved by the European Council, which is a key pillar of European Union security and defence policy. And sometimes people, I think, make the view that military neutrality means we can't be involved in any of that. That's not the case. And that's why it doesn't make sense to put general provisions into the Constitution, which could unintendedly reduce your capacity for manoeuvre into the future. So, for example, we want to be part of a European-wide approach to cyber security. I do think we need to protect ourselves. We can't protect ourselves on our own on cybersecurity. We need collaboration with other member states in the European Union and indeed with the United States in terms of technology and expertise around protecting our industry, protecting our health services and, from cybersecurity threats, because that's the new theatre
Are you opposed, as Fine Gael is, Leo Varadkar says it should set out its position on this, to the triple lock system?
No, I'm not opposed to the triple lock system, but I do believe we need to have an informed debate on this and we need to reflect on it. I think we need to take lessons from the Ukrainian crisis. Also, the vulnerabilities of European Union and the continent to a security threat. What the Russian invasion of Ukraine illustrates is the vulnerability of European security. And that's something we cannot ignore. So I've put forward the idea of a citizens' assembly, that we'd have an informed, again, evidence-based approach. Because when we talk about military neutrality, there is also the link to nuclear non-proliferation. Ireland has been a strong advocate for nuclear non-proliferation. We were one of the first signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's been a very important feature of Irish international diplomacy over many, many years. And former Fianna Fáil Foreign Minister Frank Aiken would have been the author of that.
Can you see our soldiers being part of an EU defence force in time?
Well, again, that debate is ongoing within Europe. I think we are already
part... How would it sit with you?
Well, I don't see that emerging. I think, again, I'm open in terms of how Ireland moves with the modern situation of the threats that are presented to us. The key issue for us really is military neutrality means we're not members of NATO. That's one key aspect of military neutrality. The Constitution does prevent us from joining European defence. So one would have to have a referendum, and that was part of Denise's.
But you're not opposed to asking that question of the people. That's what I'm gleaning from your answer.
Well, what I would prefer is, and you made the point that we shouldn't be bounced into this, we should give due consideration to this in an informed way. Mm-hmm. I think a citizens' assembly is a good model to do that. So we'd bring expertise and academics who have looked at this over the years, plus the people themselves. I think what's happening is that at the moment under the strategic compass now, the capacity will be there for different member states to come together in given situations
you're
or in given
we
operations.
Take our time.
Like we've already been part of peace enforcement on behalf of the European Union. We've led missions in Chad, for example.
Just before I let you go, I just want to move on because the transition between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and the Taoiseach's office, it's in the middle distance. And your 2 years as Taoiseach were spent really dealing with crises back to back. Do you regret not having those years after 2023 now to create more of a legacy?
No, I think I don't look at it that way at all. I look at it through a different prism. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you deal with the situation one has to deal with. And we have to deal with a pandemic, had to deal with it. I think the Irish people responded, in my view, magnificently to that, notwithstanding all the difficulties and tensions that arose during the course of it. And it's not over yet. I know we have to deal with a war in Ukraine. But parallel with that, last Tuesday in government, you know, we're still governing on key issues like housing and health and so on. An auto-enrolment policy in terms of pension, which is a fairly significant reform. The education reforms that Eamonn Foley announced this week in terms of the most fundamental reform of the senior cycle curriculum and leaving certificate
years. You are creating a legacy
Then the whole climate change agenda has changed dramatically from a policy perspective. Government isn't stopping doing provided in the programme for government.
When Leo Varadkar takes over, what will you do? What portfolio would you want? You've nearly done them all.
I haven't done them all.
What would you do? What would you want to do?
That's a matter we'll consider at the end of the year. At the moment, I'm focused on my job as Taoiseach and now navigating our way through this appalling crisis that we are in Europe.
Were you glad to read that Barry Cowan has ruled out a heave against you? He says Jim O'Callaghan has lost ground now.
Well, I think, again, look, the parliamentary party, I think, has been very constructive and policy focused over the last, including, and Barry himself has put forward a number of issues around energy, for example, which is a key agenda item of his in terms of the wind energy area and the need to move fast on renewables. So there's been very good discussions over the last number of months on a whole range of policy issues. And I think that's the constructive approach that we need to take.
Are you happy, though, that that's settled down? That's
I am, yes. I am indeed, yes.
And there was talk in the same article that there would sort of be a bloodless transition going into the next election. And I heard you saying on a Dairean Garrahy's podcast that your mother always said you didn't like fighting. So maybe that might be that might be what you'd prefer to see happen, that there would be a transition before the next election.
Well, advisor of mine sort of pulled out a newspaper article in 2012 or something, and it talked about a move against me. That was a long time ago. So you will read about all sorts of machinations or, you know, moves and so on.
But you're not going to be leader forever.
So the point is this, that I always work with my parliamentary party. I engage with the parliamentary party and the broader membership of the party as well, and consult and so forth. And we have a programme for government. I've always said consistently, this is about policy, not personalities. And it has to be about the party really responding to the needs of the people. We've identified housing as the key agenda. We've moved on housing. Housing for All is a fundamental policy of substance. Now that's it. And in education as well, we're making progress, notwithstanding all the challenges. And that's why I was at a school competition.
Are you saying now that you're going to lead Fianna Fáil into the next election?
Yes.
As leader?
Yes.
Micheál Martin, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you indeed.
We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.